1-800-222-8839 or humwild.org. All right, it is 5 o'clock and it is time for the next show. So this has been Penny. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Yeah, thanks. Sadly, we didn't get the interview, but we will have another. We will try to interview April and Alexandra and the urban homesteading situation there in a couple of weeks. We'll see if we can do that. Sorry about that, but hey, that's how it goes. Let's get to the next show, Public Affairs on Renewable Energy.
Welcome. This is Roby with the latest in the series of shows on energy. We're in the midst of the Fukushima nuclear accident, and of course we have the one-year anniversary of the BP oil spill and the ongoing rush to catastrophic climate change to deal with. But in the middle of all that, we have got some incredibly positive information coming our way, and the focus of the next half hour at Redwood Community Radio will be the development of renewable energies. We have as our first guest Peter Schwartzman, who has co-authored a new peer-reviewed scientific report published by the Institute for Policy Research and Development based in London. And the report concludes that the world can undergo a rapid transition to a completely renewable energy infrastructure by 2030. And is that mind-boggling or not? The study is titled A Solar Transition is Possible. Peter Schwartzman is Associate Professor and Chair of Environmental Studies at Knox College. Peter, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on your study.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're happy to have you. So tell us about the study and what it means to create a global solar power infrastructure.
Well, it's a lot to chew on, and we're very excited about it. We went in thinking this is possible. The idea is, We have an energy system currently that is 90% non-renewable, which means oil, or basically petroleum, coal, and natural gas, and nuclear, and about 10% renewable. But that's even that statistic is a bit misleading, because the 10% renewable is virtually zero. And when it relates to wind and solar, which in our mind are the two long-term sustainable renewable resources. So we went in looking at what would it take to convert our current unsustainable energy system to one that is a fully sustainable, and I mean, how much would it take in terms of fossil fuel, and how much would it take in terms of time? How long would it take? And
how long would it take for the conversion?
For the complete conversion.
Okay.
So what we are looking at is if humans, and we're looking at this on a global basis, so if humans are going to be using energy in the foreseeable future, which we imagine, they're going to need sustainable renewable energy, because the other components, all the things I've mentioned, are going to run out. And they're all going to do so in the next 100 years based on the best estimates. And some of them are probably running out a lot faster than we're being told. So what we wanted to do is determine how is it possible to transition? That is there enough fossil fuel to transition to build the solar infrastructure? When I say solar, I'm referring to infrastructure that is for both solar panels and concentrated solar, as well as wind farms. And those are the two energy sources we think are going to be the ultimate energy sources of the future.
What do you mean concentrated solar?
Right, there's a distinction. People know PV is photovoltaics, and those are what we call solar panels on people's roofs. CSP is considered concentrated solar, and that's where you have mirrors in large, large arrays of mirrors, and they reflect that light to, say, a large water tower, and it heats the water, and then that drives the energy, extraction of energy. So quite a different process, but also still solar and still renewable in our mind.
Okay, so you're not talking about solar panels distributed all over.
We are. Our model looks at the different forms of using specifically solar energy. So those would include, they would include photovoltaics.
Okay.
And whether they are in large, large grids, like they describe them in, you know, people have this image of Arizona being covered by solar panels. That's one model. But you can build those solar panel, large, solar panel outfits all over the place. In fact, there's a lot of sun everywhere, virtually, and, or you could do it on a, what we call a concentrated solar, where you're actually, you're not using, the photovoltaic panels, you're actually using, a reflective light to heat up water. But mm-hmm. they're both, you're using solar energy at its rawest form. And then, alternatively, with wind, you can imagine wind farms being very large over, landscapes, say like Silicon Valley has had for a while, or you can imagine them kind of dispersed, where you'd have wind farms in a few in a community, depending on the size, and maybe some of the more urban centers would require a vast array of them surrounding the city and so forth. But it would be the integration of both that would ultimately provide us the energy we need.
Okay, and then in your study you mentioned hydropower. Are you talking micro hydro or dams?
Okay, we are essentially, and this is important to note, in our model we are ignoring all current renewable energy. So we are starting as if we have nothing. And in some regard, we do have a little bit, right? And I mentioned we have about 10% globally that is renewable, but again, that's a misnomer in a way, because we're at capacity in most hydro plants and hydropower. Most of our rivers are, you know, dammed and so forth. So we are going to rely on solar and wind, which is the wind's going to blow and the sun's going to shine as long as humanity's on the face of the earth. And those are the two sources we're going to use. And we're going to refer to those as our solar energy, our solar renewable sustainable energy forms. Our model does not look at or doesn't require the use of other, what some people refer to as renewable energy sources, including hydropower, including ethanol, mm-hmm. Biomass, things of that nature, which there's a lot of talk about those things, but our model suggests very strongly that those things are not necessary. The only exception to that might be geothermal. And there's discussions and other papers have looked at using geothermal as a base load, because geothermal heat is heat within the earth, and that's always available. Not in humongous quantities, but enough to do some basic things. And then the wind and the solar energy would be added to that, and it would allow for there to be relatively constant energy availability across the day and across the seasons.
So in your study, you also mention that you feel we can do this transition in 30 years or less.
Right. This is. I mean, it is shocking to hear, and I think the answer, and I'll explain the details of the study in a second. The reason why it comes as a shock to people, I say there's, in my mind, there are two reasons. One is because there's so much misinformation about our future energy systems, and it shouldn't surprise us because of just the dominant forms that exist, which are non-renewable. Secondly, there's something called, the power of the exponential. So things can grow very quickly. And we know, for instance, population growth has grown very quickly, even at 1 or 2% growth a year. Well, given the following scenario, we start now in 2011. Why not start this year? We invest anywhere between 1 to 2% of our global fossil fuel. So we're using, in this case, coal, petroleum, and natural gas. In fact, we don't use nuclear at all in our model. So we use those three forms of non-renewable energy. We use 1 to 2% of them, and on an annual basis, And we invest that energy into creating the infrastructure to get solar and wind power for perpetuity. Now, of course, any solar plant you build or any wind farm you build only has a lifespan of somewhere between 20 and 30 years at this point. And that's from the literature. So what we have to do, of course, is to make it sustainable, is as we build new solar and wind capacity, we have to invest some of the energy that we derive from that into the next generation, the second generation of wind and solar. And at some point, depending on the on that percentage, and we figured out it's about 10%, then we can have wind and solar in perpetuity. So let me explain again. So we're taking 1 to 2% of our current fossil fuel use worldwide. I'll explain how we're going to get that in a minute. And that builds new solar and wind farms and plants throughout the world. Okay? Now, as we build those plants, which are going to, those solar and wind farms or plants that are going to live for the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to, there's energy that's going to be derived from those. And as we're going to use about 10% of that energy to reinvest in the building of new solar and wind plants. And it turns out that if we do that, if we do what I've just described, in 20 years, we can cut off fossil fuel use completely. And then we can begin using just the wind and the solar that we've that we're now producing and we've created the infrastructure for. We continue using 10% of that. And if we do that in perpetuity, we will, this is the amazing thing. In 28 years, we will have more than doubled the amount of available energy to humanity that we have now.
And I guess we'll need that with 9 billion people on the
planet. Well, you know, okay, this is the thing. You're right to ask that question. We will need more than we have now. And the main reason is this. Half of humanity, all right, more than 3 billion people, are essentially starving in terms of energy. And so they're going to need more energy to do the things they need to do so they can, you know, live a manageable life. Okay, they are deprived of energy, and we need to make sure that every person on the planet has basic energy needs met. At the those of us in the West, primarily, are going to have to ramp down our energy use a little bit, and in some countries, more than a little bit. Right now, in the United States, we use about twice as much energy per capita as they do in Europe.
Yeah, you had
some...
In some
cases, it's more than twice more. So we are the energy hogs of the planet.
Yeah, you had some really big figures here about conservation, and that in the United States we could potentially reduce oil consumption by more than 50% by 2025 with some aggressive energy conservation programs.
Right. Now that's work that that's work that we're drawing from. We didn't establish that ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot of waste in our energy economy. I mean, you know, the classic example is these huge automobiles that we drive everywhere. The other example is trucks, large trucks moving freight. It's a lot better for the environment from the standpoint of fuel and efficiency to move them by train. And so, and the same goes for people. It's a lot more efficient to move people by train than by car. And so part of this is suggests that we're going, we could, you know, build better infrastructure that, you know, brings back our trolleys. In the community that I live, Galesburg, believe it or not, we had trolleys running up and down our streets, bringing people throughout the community, in the 1920s. And so in a sense, we had a very sustainable energy, transportation system back in the 1920s. Now, you don't see any of that. And that, you know, there's a whole history why that happened. But that's something we need to really consider and think about. Now, what I'm suggesting, however, is, and what my co-author and I are suggesting, is that, yes, we want to ramp down our use of fossil fuels, primarily because of climate change, as well as a secondary aspect that it is very dirty. It's very polluting, not just for CO2, and climate change impacts, but all the other pollutants that come from burning gasoline and coal. And we know anyone who lives in a major industrial city, a metropolitan city in the United States or elsewhere knows that the air quality there suffers tremendously from all the burning of the fossil fuels that takes place. So we want to displace that. And if we are using solar and wind energy to provide the energy we need, we don't need those other forms. And in fact, we're going to have more energy in 30 years. I mean, we'll have more energy in about 15 years, actually, depending on how much of the fossil fuels we're willing to transfer. This transfer can go as fast. This transition can happen as fast as we want it to. We took, and this I think is very important to stress, we took very conservative estimates in virtually every parameter that we had. And that means that we're thinking 1 to 2% of our fossil fuels could be diverted to this enterprise. That is a doable amount. There's no question about it. No question about it. And largely, we just need to become more efficient. And if we become more efficient with our use of these fuels, whatever savings we have, we can use that energy to drive this transition. Secondly, we can move in terms of our aggressive nature to, once we have established solar and wind energy systems within our society, we can use that, we're saying at 10% a year, we could ramp that up to 15 or 20%. And if in so doing, we could bring about this transition even faster than we're saying. But we think, based on our report, we wanted to be conservative with our estimates, because of course the first line of attack is to say you're too optimistic. And we didn't want to be, overly optimistic. I mean, our report is very optimistic, obviously, because of all the other rhetoric you hear. But we wanted to choose numbers that really were undismissible and incontrovertible. And we think we've established that.
Yeah, because in this country, we seem to be stuck in a debate about the transition to renewables being too expensive, too difficult, basically impossible. Yet other countries seem to be moving along and developing renewables.
Right, and that's true. I mean, if you look at who's producing the most solar energy, it's Germany. Okay? Right. We think about Germany, and, one contrast is, look at the military budgets of the United States versus Germany. There's no comparison there.
I don't think you can.
We have to acknowledge, and this is the big elephant in the room, we have to acknowledge that we are spending way too much money in the trillions now of dollars per year on our military industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about 40, 50 years ago. This is a big thing. And unfortunately, the rhetoric you hear among both sides of the political spectrum right now, that's an untouchable elephant. We have to cut social programs, we have to cut this, we have to cut that. We have to look at how we can transition. And the biggest source of funds is going to be in ways of ramping down our military dollars. And this is an interesting point, because I think true security, and that's what defense is all about, true security will come when all people on the planet have basic access to energy. And so this is a security, it would make sense to me to transition our funds from what we call military defense to solar security. And that's one way to think about it. Now, is that absolutely necessary? We probably think it is, because it's not just the actual physical dollars, but it's also the mindset that comes with it. If people saw the security in having renewable, sustainable energy system, that's going to open up doors in whole kinds of ways. One other thing, though, is there is money to be had, but unfortunately, the last 20 years, the investment in renewable energy, specifically wind and solar, has been a pittance in this country. There's been a lot of talk about the increased renewable energy subsidies, basically. And we should understand, for the last 50 years, the fossil fuel industry has received amazing subsidies. for fuel. And this is why our gasoline, you know, even though it's $4 a gallon now, is still a lot cheaper here than it is in other parts of the world, especially in Europe. But since it's we've been subsidizing, and that is paying for it through our taxes, the fossil fuel industry, we have not been, therefore, supporting in any direct way the solar and the wind. And in recent years, the monies that have gone towards renewables have gone towards ethanol, primarily, the vast majority. And again, that is not in our best interest. Ethanol may be a renewable resource, but no one will tell you that ethanol is going to drive all the cars we have. And yet, what I'm saying and what we're saying is by 2035, or actually the year, in the next 28 years, so 2039, say, we should be able to have enough energy to power everything that we have now and more. Now, be careful when I say more. When I say more, I'm not saying more cars per person or more, you know, bigger homes per person. I'm saying more is a higher quality of life. And that will mean that we can have, you know, public transportation systems that are phenomenal, that are not only beautiful and efficient and ideal forms of transportation and on time and you know, reliable. All those things can come if we choose them.
Right. We just have to have the will of those in power, which I imagine is what the obstacles are here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two obstacles. Surely there's going to have to be a shift in consciousness among society. A lot of folks that we speak to, even those who are maybe inclined to believe what we've done, they're hesitant to believe it because it's too surprising, it's too shocking.
It's too good to believe, considering we are bombarded on a regular, I'd say daily basis with the fact that this is what we have to do. We have to drill. We have to have nuclear. We have to do this. There are not alternatives in renewables. We're told this on a regular basis.
We are. And who's funding all that information? I mean, of course, the biggest profit seekers and makers of the last 10 years, even through this recession, have been the energy industries. And they're very upfront about it. They're not hiding. They, you know, meanwhile, right, we have tragedies in the Gulf, two of them. We have the nuclear collapse in Japan. I'm living in a community that in some ways is surrounded by nuclear power. Most people in Illinois don't realize that we have more nuclear power plants in our state than any other state in the country. And the United States is the largest generator of nuclear power in the world. We don't realize that because these utilities are hidden. They're kind of behind the scenes. They're not, you know, in your backyard or my backyard, but they exist and they're there and they're, you know, that's a horror. Why would you want to live in a society or in a community with that threat? Wind and solar power is not another element of the security is that it's much less, you know, virtually zero comparatively, in the security, the risk of major catastrophe on humanity. Sure, wind turbines may break down and solar panels may, you know, break down over time, but it's not going to cause the type of devastation we've seen in many parts of our country and on the world scale. And more importantly, I think if we have energy to supply to people on a worldly scale, that's going to bring a sense of peace and value and equity and that we need. Now, another piece, you said that the other part of the hurdle is convincing people, and this is the hardest part, that the answer does not, that the answer exists, but it's not being widely promulgated. You know, this paper's been out now for about a month?
A month, yeah.
And, you know, we have not been, interviewed on a national basis, international basis. And, you know, I hope the tide will turn on that. But at a time when we have catastrophes occurring on almost a yearly basis related to energy, and the price of gas is going through the roof, and you know, the list goes on, you would think that this study would be worth more time and thought. And look, we're open to critique. We want that critique. We've basically feel like we've started the debate, and we need to have the debate. It needs to be kind of a national debate. And for instance, we have a website called solarutopia.org. That's where we've put our paper and some slides that people can look at and kind of walk through to understand what we're talking about. We hope that that website and other sites will begin to churn and serve as the locations, the locuses for continued conversations along these lines. And eventually, you know, things percolate. In my view, they percolate from the bottom up. And in time, you know, our statesmen will hear that there are other alternatives. It's not that crazy a concept. And I'll give you an analogy which people can look into. For instance, right now in the world, there are, you know, millions of people who don't have access, you know, billions of people that don't have access to clean water. And millions of them die every day because of that. We have very simple technologies that exist. They're like clay pots that sift and serve as sieves to create clean water. Those things exist now, and they're being utilized in some communities. They should be widespread and, you know, delivered globally. It would reduce the misery and bring a happy face on billions of people's faces. But yet, why isn't it happening? Because one, most people don't know it exists. Two, I think we're so distracted by so many other things, including the misinformation that you referred to. And so we're in a state of kind of malaise where we don't think the answers exist and that we're waiting for, I don't know, some apocalypse. I don't think it has to happen that way. And that's part of the purpose of our paper. Once we realized that this could happen, we went in not knowing. You know, maybe it would be 100 years, and then, you know, that wouldn't be so exciting. We're talking about one generation.
Well, we're talking about almost immediate, considering those years. Peter, we've run out of time. It actually went way quicker than I imagined. But I want to give a minute here so that we can refer people to the website that they can read the study for themselves, the Institute for Policy Research and Development, and your website, IPRD.org.uk, is that correct?
Right, .uk. That's the Institute's website, and they have our paper. And in the appendix there of that paper is also a reference to the website I mentioned, which is solarutopia.org.
Okay, and I've been speaking with Peter Schwartzman from the Institute for Policy Research and Development. And I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us, explaining this to us, and we'll be back in touch, because this is the best thing I've heard about in ages, and we've got to get the word out.
Well, I really sincerely thank you for sharing your time with me and allowing folks to at least hear about this and give it some thought, and let's start moving.
Well, thanks for joining us today. That was really exciting information, and we will get back to that. We'll do another show on renewables May 12th, so please join us then for the ongoing discussion of how we can move our society in the direction it needs to go.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 21st of April, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, human rights advocates condemn the repression of peaceful protesters in northern Iraq. We go to Honduras, where community radio broadcasters are facing death threats, shootings, and other intimidation.
Mostly they were beating people, arresting them, or putting them into ambulances.
And 1 year after the BP oil spill disaster, we look at the effect on the Gulf's marine life, including dolphins and endangered sea turtles.
This spring, a lot of dolphins are miscarrying, so the Gulf has never seen so many dead young and infant and stillborn dolphins wash up on shore.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Haiti's Electoral Commission has officially declared pop singer Michel Martelly the winner of March's presidential election. This announcement caps off an extended electoral process marked by protests, violence, and accusations.